Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to the second part of a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama, a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University. He delivered the talk to the Yale Institute for Social and Policy Studies on January the 22nd, 2003, reprising the themes of his book, Our Post-Human Future. Dr. Fukuyama serves on the President's Council on Bioethics and is a well-known conservative intellectual and also author of The End of History.
Now, the second path has to do with life extension. In fact, if you go to a well-stocked newsstand, there's actually a popular magazine called Life Extension. It's something that many people ardently hope for. There's a lot of research that goes into this area. I think that one of the greatest achievements of 20th century biomedicine was obviously the extension of life expectancies in developed countries, so that whereas it had been, you know, down in the 40s at the end of the last century, it's now in the 70s and up into the 80s for women at the end of the 20th century in virtually every developed country. And that has opened up clearly, you know, new vistas for people more. But all of that cumulative impact of biomedicine actually did not alter the, in a sense, the natural human lifespan. I mean, most of what that was accomplishing was allowing more people to live to their natural lifespan. Since most, the low life expectancies at the end of the 19th century, a lot of that was due to high rates of infant mortality and people dying young. So now we've allowed, you know, through conventional medicine, through public health improvements in public health, many more people to live to their natural through their natural lifespans. There is, of course, a lot of disagreement as to what the future holds in terms of life extension. I know that there are many gerontologists that think that we are at a point of diminishing returns and that, you know, the reason that people die is that essentially there are a whole lot of systems that all give out, you know, more or less simultaneously, and there's no simple fix for any of that. There are, however, some intriguing discoveries about the genetic basis of, for example, antioxidants and other things that delay the aging process. And some people, some I think quite serious molecular biologists, that think that there might actually be a relatively, a genetic shortcut to the broad problem of life extension. Now, I am not a biologist. I have no way of knowing which of these theories is credible, although it does seem to me that cumulatively probably one of the safest bets you can make is that the overall impact of advances in biomedicine over the next generation or two will be to extend human lifespans beyond what they are now. Now, the question is, what are the political and social consequences of extended lifespans? In many respects, Europe and Japan are living with some of those consequences now. They are experiencing a very dramatic shift in their demographic balance. It's not simply that people are living longer, of course. It is a very dramatic drop in fertility that has, I think, largely sociological, not biological, explanations. Countries like Italy and Spain and Japan are down to total fertility rates of something like 1.1 or 1.2. This is the average number of children per woman per lifetime. The replacement rate is something like 2.2 to 2.3. So that all of these countries are experiencing population loss and an increase in the median ages of their populations. And some of the statistics on this are really staggering. Every country in Europe is losing over 1% of native-born population per year, every year in and year out, which means that they'll lose 30% of their native-born population every generation. You take another century of this, and Germany essentially disappears off the map. Of course, the absolute numbers slow down as the absolute population decreases, but it's a very dramatic change. Now, most people are perfectly aware of this demographic. Oh, and incidentally, in terms of median ages, with no large increase in net immigration, a country like Italy with the total fertility rate of 1.2 will have a median age of something like 59 by the year 2050, meaning 50% of the population is 60 or older. And, you know, frankly, there has never been a human society on Earth that has had this particular age structure. Now, a lot of people in looking at public policy, the public policy implications of this, have been quite aware of this shift, and most of it is discussed in terms of the Social Security liability that this produces, so that Japan is moving from a situation where they had four workers for every retired person very rapidly to a situation where they've only got two workers for every retired person. And you get similar numbers, you know, that will emerge in Europe over the next generation. Incidentally, the United States is a little bit exempt from this because we have high rates of immigration and also higher rates of fertility among native-born Americans for various reasons. But there are some other interesting consequences of this shift in the demographic structure as well. And incidentally, all of these predictions are based not on any prediction about great advances in life extension in the future. This is all based on trends that are already, you know, very well locked into place. But consider, you know, the following. Our society, although it is meritocratic and democratic, is totally dependent on age-graded hierarchies. That is to say, the older you are, the higher status you have. This is true of corporate boards, of managerial hierarchies. It's true of tenured professors in university departments. It's true throughout virtually every organization that exists, except for things like sports teams that are dependent on, you know, healthy 20-year-old athletes. And all of those really depend, the viability of those age-graded hierarchies really depend on generational turnover. You have these pyramids where you get smaller numbers of people as you go up the status ladder, but if, in fact, you have this dramatic increase in the number of people that are living to later and later ages, that pyramid is going to start looking like a trapezoid or eventually like a rectangle that has very long and high sides. Now, this is not something that societies cannot adjust to over time, but it is going to take a dramatic adjustment in our expectations so that people will have to, for example, no longer expect that they will get an education when they're in their teens and 20s that will last them pretty much through their lifetimes until the time they retire. Because if you have the inability of these hierarchies to, you know, wean employees at the higher, you know, status jobs, and clearly there's going to have to be some other mechanism for getting people off of that status ladder and forcing them to start over again. This also has important implications, I think, for things like the rate of progress, overall progress, and social and cultural adjustment in societies, because it, I think, is a, you know, a fact of human mentality that people's worldviews and, you know, cognitive Weltanschauungs tend to get set by the time they're about 25 or 30. I mean, the events that you experience, you know, up to that age are usually the ones that determine whether you're a liberal or a conservative, you know, whether you are worried constantly about a new depression coming and therefore save any penny, or whether you're a free spender. And most of the important social changes in our life, you know, take place on these generational cycles, precisely because each generational cohort is shaped by, you know, the certain life experiences they had as young people. Now, if you extend each generational cycle out past 25 years, you clearly get, you know, changes in the rate that societies can adjust. For example, I mean, just to give you a real-world example of this, in the former Soviet Union, in a country like Russia, at this point, the only people that vote communist are people over the age of 60 or 65, because that's the world that they grew up in. People at you know, younger ages simply don't vote communist, and these people will continue to vote communist really until the you know, until the time they die. So there's a big social adjustment problem that is solved by the natural succession of generations, but will slow down dramatically if there is you know, if there is a this kind of change in the you know, in the natural generational cycle. Now, the third pathway is that of germline genetic engineering, which, as I said, is what many people associate with. I mean, it's doing to human beings what agricultural biologists do routinely today to plants, to snip one gene out and put another one in. I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of doing this. Certainly the difficulty of doing it safely are enormous, and there are many people that I think are quite credible that say that the difficult, I mean, first of all, that the, you know, the genetic causation is so inherently complex, so many things are due to the interaction, the complex interaction of multiple genes, that our ability to ever actually alter anything of importance to us, like intelligence or even something like height, it will be very limited. And that that may well be the case. However, I do think that this technological possibility, if it comes about, will have perhaps the most profound consequences, because I think that they get to a certain layer of ethical determination that the other ones don't, which is the sense that in many respects what we are as a species, what our essence is as a species, is very very much related to what we regard our dignity and our rights as human beings to be. Let me just illustrate this. In 1776, Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, in the year 1776, and in the republic that was formed after 1789, neither women nor African Americans had a right to participate in the political system. They were denied rights. And they were denied rights not because all human beings didn't have rights, but they were not considered to be fully human beings. That, you know, women were considered too emotional, blacks, you know, were considered not to have the right mental capabilities and so forth. One of the great achievements, I think, of, in a sense, of 20th century science was to debunk the empirical basis of those kinds of distinctions, and that to say that, you know, you really have certain characteristics that are secondary, like skin color, and gender or ethnicity, and other characteristics that are primary, that constitute the essence of what it means to be a human being, and that we assign human and political rights to people that have those essential characteristics. And a technology that is, and you know, it was only less than 100 years ago that you had the systematic denial of rights based on these kinds of perceived biological differences. And so therefore, if you did have a biotechnology that was powerful enough to reinsert those differences into human populations, then I think it would inevitably have implications for the way we think about rights. Now, let me just, you know, having gone through those three pathways, let me just lay out what I think is at least my concern in all of this. I said that broadly speaking, I think that there are political implications having to do with the possibility of new mechanisms or technologies for social control. And I think that, and I'd like to specify a little bit more what I think is problematic about the exercise of that social control, because, of course, we try to socially control all sorts of people. I have children, and I try to socially engineer their outcomes, you know, make sure they go to school and have good educations and a lot of other things. And so social control is not illegitimate. And so you have to, I think, specify what is the problem with these new technologies that makes them particularly particularly problematic. I think most of the problems, and this is actually something that the Bioethics Council has been focused on for the last, ever since we got done with cloning and embryos, we've really focused on this question, has to do with what I would call the non-therapeutic uses of biomedicine, which in turn is based on a distinction between therapeutic uses of medicine and enhancement or non-therapeutic uses. Now, there is, of course, an immediate retort to this, which is that the distinction between therapy and enhancement is one that is very difficult to draw. Is Viagra a therapy or an enhancement? Or is, you know, treating someone for cancer or for a stroke or heart attack at the age of 80 a therapy or an enhancement? I mean, in some sense, you could say that that's an enhancement because, you know, that's what killed people in the natural world of, let's say, hunter-gatherer societies. And so I admit that that is a distinction that is hard to draw, but at either end of the spectrum, it does seem to me that there are certain things that are clearly therapeutic. If you have a child with you know, Huntington's chorea or cystic fibrosis, that is traceable to a clear genetic abnormality that has clearly, you know, devastating results for any kind of normal human development. And by contrast, if you administer growth hormone to somebody that is likely to be in the 50th percentile for height, you know, that is not by any stretch, I think, a therapeutic use of medicine. One further thing that complicates this is what I mentioned earlier is this, you know, perpetually expanding domain of the therapeutic, where there's this constant effort to get more and more things declared as diseases that, in fact, you know, represent, in some sense, normal conditions. But that's a separate kind of issue.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama on his book, Our Post-Human Future, delivered January 22nd, 2003 at Yale University.
All right, so what is the problem, broadly speaking, with the non-therapeutic uses of medicine? And I think that you can divide the problems into a social level and an individual level. Let me begin with the social level. And by the social level, I mean these are things that become problematic when everybody does it. You know, when an individual uses an enhancement technology, it may not matter so much, but if everybody is doing it, then it becomes a problem. And economists are actually quite good. I mean, they have a conceptual framework for understanding this sort of thing. For example, there are many objects of enhancement that constitute, in effect, what you would call a positional good. You know, a game theorist would say that the, you know, the benefit that an individual derives, they're playing a zero-sum game with other individuals, where it's your relative advantage or the status relative to other people that constitutes the good. And there are actually quite a lot of things in life that are this way. Some people may want a nice Jaguar because they just love the look of a beautiful carburetor and, you know, all those 12 cylinders gleaming. But other people like it because their neighbor has a BMW and it, you know, gives them a leg up on the Joneses. And so actually a lot of what counts as economic motivation actually, you know, has to do with this quest for positional goods. Now, the thing about a zero-sum game is that many of the concepts in economics, like Pareto optimality, don't apply. If one person wins, another person loses, and if you engage in a zero-sum game, there's no net winner for the society as a whole. And some of these enhancement goals are like that. Something like height, for example, being of below average stature myself, I can readily appreciate that it would have been nice to be born, you know, 6 inches higher. But if I had been born in the Middle Ages, I wouldn't have had any problem because my relative height would have been, you know, I may have been, you know, actually quite tall in the year 1500. And in a sense, you know, something like the quest for height is a battle that no one can win. You can individually be better off if you're high, if you have height relative to other people, but the society itself can't get better off by people engaging in that kind of an arms race. Now, a second set of problems has to do with what economists call negative externalities. That is to say, effects on third parties, either good or bad, that are produced by, you know, a private transaction or things that are individually rational but socially have negative consequences. Sex selection, I would say, in Asia today constitutes exactly that sort of thing, where it is, for cultural reasons, individually rational for parents in Korea or China to prefer to have a male offspring. That's their social security. There are a lot of cultural reasons for this kind of male preference. That preference has led in South Korea to an excess of boys over girls of something like 122 to 100 at birth. Normal sex ratio at birth is about 105 boys to 100 girls, and in South Korea, you're getting an excess of as much as, you know, 20% of the population. The ratio in the People's Republic of China is something like 117 to 100, which if you scale that up to the size, you know, it's got 1.2 billion people, which means that there are tens of millions of excess males being born in that country as a result of the easy access of people to sonograms and abortions. And I think that it is a socially, first of all, it's individually rational, but to be a male growing up in that kind of society means that you have very diminished expectations of finding a mate, and it also produces negative externalities because, you know, having a fifth of your young male population not able to get a family, marry someone and settle down with children is a good formula for social instability. That's where most of the crime and revolution and general social discontent comes from. So that's another example of an externality. Another one, I think, is life extension. Life extension is something that every individual would like, but it's not obviously good for society if, in fact, it produces slower rates of social adaptation by abolishing natural generational turnover. Then it is something that is individually desirable but collectively negative. Final social level problem has to do with non-linearities and unexpected consequences, particularly when you start doing things like manipulating emotions and characteristics of personality. In my view, evolution, the evolutionary process that produced the species Homo sapiens, although it was a blind in many respects random process, has produced a creature whose interlocking mental characteristics and particularly emotional characteristics are extraordinarily complex and interrelated to one another in ways that we oftentimes do not understand. And I think that it's, you know, quite common to say, you know, people speculating about the future would say, well, we can obviously distinguish good emotions or good human characteristics from bad ones. You know, we don't like many aspects of human nature. We don't like the propensity for violence, for aggression, for hatred, for, you know, clannishness or group identity that excludes, you know, out-group people. And if those could be appropriate targets of some medical technology to change, what is the problem with doing that? And I think the answer to that is that all of these, you know, the attempt to change any one of these emotional characteristics will have unintended consequences because we do not understand the functionality of those particular, especially the negative emotions in that evolutionary package. Something like aggression, for example, or, you know, certain forms of competitiveness or certain kinds of group identity are very intimately bound up with human sociability. And it seems to me very difficult to talk about altering, you know, one aspect of that sociability without altering, without it altering others. Final thing is not on social level consequences, but individual level consequences. Many of the targets of this kind of enhancement technology, I think, will be, again, characteristics where it is very hard to unambiguously say what constitutes an enhancement. You know, the typical targets are things like intelligence or looks, where there seems to be a fair degree of consensus as to what's good and what's desirable as an enhancement. But I would say that for most important human characteristics, it's just not clear what constitutes a better human being. Let's take the case of homosexuality. There does seem to be both a genetic and a biological basis towards a propensity for homosexuality. If this were a target of an enhancement technology such that, you know, it wouldn't even have to depend on the finding of a gay gene. It could be that, you know, if you have the appropriate, you know, fetal levels of fetal testosterone, you can masculinize the brain and, you know, therefore avoid, you know, whatever biological propensity may exist in utero for having a gay offspring. If this were as easily available to parents as, you know, sonograms and abortions are in Asia, what would be the social level consequences of that if people could make this decision in the privacy of their doctor's offices? And if, as I suspect, many parents would choose, you know, all other things being equal, including, you know, ones that have no prejudice against gays whatsoever, if they chose, you know, to, in a sense, safeguard their offspring from having this tendency and you know, had a reduction of gays in the population, does that constitute an enhancement of the human population? I think not. And particularly when you get into psychological characteristics, this whole area of what constitutes a better personality and a better human being gets extremely politicized and dicey. There is something in DSM-4 called oppositional disorder. You can look it up, you know, you can read the symptoms, and you can, if you're a psychiatrist, diagnose a kid as having oppositional disorder. The other people that had this thing called oppositional disorder was Soviet psychiatry, you know, that regarded any political opponent of the regime as mentally unbalanced. And, you know, I think it illustrates the, you know, some of the real difficulties in under, you know, that if these enhancement technologies can be used to manipulate human behavior in these fashions. Are we really talking about enhancement, or are we actually talking about things that are deliberately designed to socially control human behavior in ways that we may not agree with? I'm going to stop there. I have, at lunch, I gave a talk on what, in my opinion, you do about all of this, which is you regulate it. I believe that people have shied away from this topic because they are pessimistic about the ability of societies to control technology. I actually think that that's our record in controlling technology is not actually all that bad, and that this is something where you have enough, you know, human values at stake that you need to have some system that permits us to enjoy the real benefits that biotechnology will bring while having some say over the more morally questionable uses. But I'm not going to go into that at any length. If you want to bring that up in the question and answer period, I invite you to do that. But with that, I thank you for your attention.
A member of the audience asked how the new biotechnologies might exacerbate inequality in the world.
Well, you know, I think that one perfectly legitimate worry about this kind of technology is that it will be yet another factor that enhances existing social stratifications, and in fact could enhance them, you know, in ways that will be much more serious than the existing stratifications, and that's both on a domestic and on an international level. You know, today in sub-Saharan Africa, you've got not only this big AIDS crisis, but you've got a, you know, huge crisis with tropical malaria that has now become resistant to a lot of the medicines that were used against it a generation or two ago. And that's actually an easily solvable, well, not easily, but it's a solvable problem. The problem is that there's just a market failure because, you know, you get a lot of poor people that live in sub-Saharan Africa, and they're not the ones that can pay for, you know, the drug trials and so forth to develop those cures. And so in that part of the world, you have clearly therapeutic uses of medicine that are going unanswered. And in the developed world, you have people beginning to think about these non-therapeutic, very, you know, expensive uses of medicine. So that's, you know, just in terms of a single society, you could say, well, look, we tolerate a lot of inequality as it is. You know, this may add to it a little bit. Rich people will enhance their children. So what's, you know, why is this different in kind? And I think the reason that it is different in kind is that, you know, to the extent that it's done, for example, through, you know, through germline, I think it does, you know, reinforce the, or it at least introduces the possibility of actually kind of natural differences of type that, you know, is one of the characteristics that fortunately our species doesn't have a lot of. I mean, there are, you know, a lot of superficial differences, but in most of the characteristics that we regard as important, we are a pretty homogeneous species. And so if you have a technology that can reintroduce real group differences within that species, then I think it will, you know, lead not just to a de facto increase in inequality, but also to people thinking that there's a, you know, a more principled form of inequality.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama, a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University, which he delivered to the Yale Institute for Social and Policy Studies on January the 22nd, 2003. This is the second half of the talk. If you'd like to listen to the first half of the talk in streaming MP3, visit the Change Surfer website at www.changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.